You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Steelworkers District 11 and the International Association of Machinists, Local 778. United Steelworkers District 11, representing 33,000 members in the Midwest, protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers of Local Lodge 778 in Kansas City, Missouri, represents thousands of working-class people in and around the metro. Our members work in a variety of industries, including automotive, manufacturing, freight and logistics, and public works. We proudly support the Heartland Labor Forum as it continues to educate our friends and neighbors about the issues affecting Missouri's working-class families. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we'll look at what's in store for workers in the 2019 Missouri and Kansas legislative sessions. Will Missouri continue with unpopular bills that the people will override? Will Kansas expand Medicaid or reinstate prevailing wage? We'll talk to Missouri Representative Judy Morgan and then to Kansas Representative Tom Burrows. In the news, striking assembly workers in Matamoros, Mexico, are winning 20% raises. And Oklahoma legislature moving to retaliate against teachers for last year's walkout. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. He's going to be talking about fallout on federal contract workers from the government shutdown. And now for the news.
Now news from our side, January 31st, 2019. This comes from the IBEW Media Center. The Federal Labor Relations Authority, which oversees administration and enforcement of local labor law for federal employees, has its own staff union. The chair of the FLRA is Colleen Kiko. She's a Trump appointee, and when the staff union's contract ran out December 21st, she unilaterally terminated it, refused to negotiate a new one, and withdrew recognition from the union. This illegal action is from the director of the agency that's supposed to enforce the federal labor law. The union, which is called the UAE, represents about 50 agency workers, mostly lawyers who handle labor law management dispute for 2.1 million non-postal federal workers, a figure that includes thousands of IBEW members employed by the federal government. So for 40 years, the UAE was organized. KIKO decides that that law categorically exempts FLRA employees from the same rights that protect employees in other executive branch agencies. So if you work for the agency that enforces federal labor law and your director says you have no rights, whom do you appeal to? IBEW President Lonnie R. Stevenson said this shows the current level of contempt for workers from the Trump administration and Mitch McConnell. This contempt, he says, has led us to where we are today, a government shutdown that has 800,000 federal workers, FLRA included, panicking about paying their bills and taking care of their families. The FLRA's work has been hampered long before the shutdown by the Trump administration's failure to nominate a general counsel, leaving the agency without anyone to prosecute unfair labor practice claims on behalf of federal employees, unions, and agencies.
Last week, Los Angeles teachers won a historic victory for teachers and for school children. Last year, teachers in Oklahoma won gains in an unprecedented work stoppage. Now their legislature wants to make sure that never happens again and is trying to cut off teacher activism at the knees. CNN reports that a bill being considered would make it illegal for teachers to walk out and protest. House Bill 2214 goes even further by permanently revoking the certifications of teachers who break the rule, preventing them from ever teaching in the state again. The bill's sponsor, Representative Todd Russ, says he introduced it to make sure kids don't suffer a disruption in their education. It's already illegal for teachers to go on strike in Oklahoma, but last year, hundreds of teachers flooded the state capitol for 9 days, demanding more school funding and higher raises. They were able to do so because that protest was a walkout, not a strike. Alicia Priest, president of the Oklahoma Education Association, said that a teacher's strike happens when battling a school board. During a strike, teachers usually protest while they're supposed to be in school. But with last year's walkout, many teachers told their administrators they'd be absent. That forced some school districts to cancel classes. Since there wouldn't be enough educators in the schools, since many schools were closed, teachers could protest at the Capitol without punishment. So were students hurt, or was education helped by the walkout? Priest said students made up most of the missed days at the end of the school year. Before the walkout, some veteran teachers had to work about 10 years to crack the $40,000 salary mark. To support their families, some teachers worked 3 to 6 jobs. The fight wasn't just about raises, though. Teachers wanted more school funding. As high school students read from textbooks as old as they were, sometimes 70 students had to share 25 textbooks. As a result, threatening to walk out, more money was appropriated for schools, and teachers got a significant raise. They didn't win more as a result of the 9-day walkout, but the OEA president said it was the threat of a walkout that spurred lawmakers to give schools more funding. Had teachers been forbidden to walk out, we would not have gotten the increases for our students that we gained.
Strikes in Matamoros, just across the border from Brownsville, Texas, are continuing into the third week. At their height, thousands of workers at 45 plants, which produce parts and finished products mainly for the U.S. market, were on strike for their end-of-the-year 2018 bonus, which employers failed to pay, and to be included in the massive increase in the minimum wage that the new Mexican president, Andres Manuel López Obrador, promised. The plants are called maquilas or maquiladoras, and their managers are complaining about losses and threatening to leave Mexico for countries where labor is even cheaper. The fact is, Mexican wages have risen only slightly since NAFTA was implemented in 1994. They're lower than Chinese wages currently, and workers are kept at the edge of subsistence while the multinational corporations that employ them make large profits. Reuters reports that several Mexican business lobbies, including the Auto Industry Association, said some manufacturers had accepted the workers' demands so that they could resume production and make deadlines on contracts. The Washington Post reported yesterday that 27 of 48 assembly plants have settled after winning wage increases of 20%. Factories make auto parts, medical equipment, plastics, and other goods. The union of the maquila industry of Matamoros said Tuesday about 20 companies with a total of 27 plants agreed to raise wages and pay workers a one-time bonus of $1,685.
This from The Guardian. Foxconn is reconsidering plans to make advanced liquid crystal display panels at a $10 billion Wisconsin campus and says it intends to hire mostly engineers and researchers rather than the manufacturing workforce the project originally promised. Announced at a White House ceremony in 2017, the 20 million square foot campus marked the largest greenfield investment by a foreign-based company in U.S. history and was praised by Donald Trump as proof of his ability to revive American manufacturing. The deal relied on a potential $4.8 billion in subsidies and has proved highly controversial. It was pushed heavily by Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and Congressman Paul Ryan. Both are no longer elected officials, but their mega subsidies are still in force. One of the deal's biggest critics, Randy Bryce, a former iron worker who lives near the Foxconn site and ran for House Speaker Paul Ryan's seat as a Democrat, said that the deal appeared to be unraveling. "It shows what happens when government puts corporations before people," said Bryce. "They absolutely should not get that money now." Foxconn initially planned to manufacture advanced large-screen displays for TVs and other consumer and professional products at the facility, which is under construction. It later said it would build smaller LCD screens instead. Now, those plans may be scaled back even further or even shelved. That was Louis Wu, the special assistant to Foxconn chief executive Terry Gu, told Reuters. The news tonight was read by Tom Gepkin, Jeff Milliken, Judy Ansel, and I'm Jen Zaman. And now, here is Kim Claus with her segment for tonight.
Hi, this is Kim Claus, and it's that time of year again. The Missouri Legislature current session started on January 9th. Every year, it is a bumpy ride, full of nail-biting moments, especially for working people. Here to tell us what's going on so far and what may be in store for us is Representative Judy Morgan. Judy,
hi, how are you?
Hello. It's always a pleasure to have you on the Heartland Labor Forum. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you. It's always good to be here.
So first, let's talk just a little bit about this session in general. We have new leadership. So what do you think?
Well, it's kind of interesting. We've got new leadership for both the Democrats and the Republicans, and they both happen to come from Springfield, which is kind of unusual. It's sort of an interesting session. I don't feel like I know the Republican speaker very well. We've served together since 2012, I think. But our Democratic leader is Crystal Quaid, and she is really a very energetic, passionate woman. And so I'm really happy to be serving with her as our leader. The session has kind of gotten off to a really slow start. Which is the way it used to be. When I first came here, we would start off kind of slowly and have time to organize our offices, you know, sponsor bills, get to know each other, that kind of thing, have time to really talk to our constituents and groups. But the last 2 years have been crazy with, you know, Right to Work in 2017 and then the whole Greitens saga in 2018. So
sure.
It's just kind of been a slow start, which isn't necessarily bad. I think there's some good points to that.
Oh, absolutely. So let's talk about Clean Missouri, otherwise known as Amendment 1, on the November ballot. And can you give us a quick refresher on what that was and tell us what's going on with that in the legislature now?
Sure. Well, I think it had about six components. One was limiting lobbyist gifts to, like, you know, $5, like kind of the cup of coffee rule. Whereas, you know, before that, you know, a lot of people, they had lots of expensive gifts in terms of food, drink, you know, conferences, sporting game tickets, concert tickets. Well, all that's gone. The most that a lobbyist can spend is $5. The revolving door, meaning the time between when the legislator would be at the end of their legislative term and become a lobbyist, has been changed from 6 months, which is what it is what it has been, to 2 years. So now you're not going to have legislators leaving one day and becoming lobbyists, you know, very quickly. They're going to have to wait 2 years.
Right.
It had transparency of records, saying that all of our records as legislators would be open to the Sunshine Law. Now, there are some stipulations that close some stuff, but anything under Sunshine Law that's open for everybody else would have to be open for us. Probably the part that I liked the best was the redistricting. Mm-hmm. It would have an independent, nonpartisan demographer who would actually draw the district lines for the legislative districts, which happens once every 10 years after the Senate. So we would be coming up in 2020 to go through that again. I think that would really be fairer and less partisan, so that, you know, you would not have these districts that are made just so that a Republican could be elected or a Democrat could be elected. So those were some of the main components of Clean Missouri.
And that was an amendment, right? A constitutional
amendment. So it's in the Constitution, which should mean it's set in stone, which means it can't change unless the voters decide, again, through the whole amendment process to change it. But I think it was about the second week of session, one of the things we did do is we go through our rules, which govern our proceedings here in the Missouri House. And our Missouri House leadership decided that they thought that Clean Missouri, in terms of the transparency, was wrong, and that the legislators, anything with their constituents and anything that relates to caucus strategy, should be something that is not necessarily open to the public. And so they actually did a rule as part of our rules of, you know, our procedures, that says the individual rep is going to get to decide what he or she thinks they should keep confidential in terms of constituent stuff and caucus strategy. Now, the Sunshine Law already protects the you know, your identity in terms of constituent stuff. So if some reporter asks for my emails by Clean Missouri, I'm supposed to give them to them. And then, but I could redact like people's names and stuff like that, so
right,
that their names are, you know, they're blocked out. So now the Missouri House has just said, you know, we're going to like say, forget Clean Missouri on this. We think we're right. And we think our rules will allow us to do this. Now, the thing I think they forgot is that the Constitution trumps any statute.
Right.
You know, this is in statute. So I am guessing there's going to be a court case. And at some point, I am hopeful that the courts will say, no, the voters said they want those records transparent. So anything that currently can be, you know, gotten through the Sunshine Law, you legislators are going to have to give it up.
Right. But meanwhile, I guess they're just going on the rules that are on.
Now, we did get a request. I think it was right after the beginning of December when Clean Missouri actually went into effect.
Uh-huh.
And I think all the legislators got a request for all of our emails from December 1st through 10th. And I just, you know, we went ahead and forwarded all of our emails to them. So we complied. You know, I don't know if everybody complied, but I think the members of the Democratic caucus, you know, we were encouraged to comply because that's the amendment now. That's what's the law of the land.
Yeah. Do you think that was just to test it? Do you think that was?
Yes, I think it was just to test it. I don't think they were trying to get anybody or anything like that. I think it was just a matter to test it. And you know, I think the thing that, you know, the thing we should not be doing in our emails is, you know, seeking campaign contributions, you know, or
right,
talking about our elections. And I think there's probably been some of that goes on through the Missouri House email, and that's what needs to stop.
Right.
And I think some of these folks, they don't want to comply with that.
Right, right. Well,
so
too bad.
I think there'll be a move afoot to also do something about the redistricting.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans really don't like the redistricting. They don't like the fact that there's an independent, nonpartisan demographer that's appointed by the auditor. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we see legislation to also interfere with that whole redistricting process.
Now, my guess is I can pretty much understand why they wouldn't like an independent person,
right,
independent demographer, because they really like the way they redistricted in 2010.
Yes.
But do they have a story about why they would? I mean, is it because our auditor is a Democrat?
That's what they're saying. The auditor is a Democrat, but it has to go through a process where the independent demographers go through an application process, and I think that the leadership of both the Missouri House and Senate have to, there's so many names submitted to them, and if they don't agree on a name, then the auditor picks it. I think that's the way it goes. So there's a chance for them to agree on a name.
Right.
So I don't think that their objection is legitimate myself.
Right.
I totally support what Clean Missouri did, and so there again, I'm sure if there's some kind of, trying to do away with the redistricting part of Clean Missouri, I'm guessing there will be a lawsuit on that too.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, lawsuits kind of abound right now. There's several lawsuits going on with House Bill 1413 that attacked the public sector unions last year, right? We're in the middle of lawsuits for that and waiting to see if they will grant an injunction on that.
Right.
But I digress. So when we first got a look at pre-filed bills in December, so many people in this state were frustrated to see that right-to-work bills were already filed.
Yes.
And, you know, as a reminder, that was Proposition A that was voted on in August, and the voters were very clear that we don't want right to work in the state. So what's going on with
67%.
Right.
You know, 67% of the voters said no to right to work, just like 62% said yes to Clean Missouri. So those were both overwhelming victories. You're exactly right. There's a couple of bills that have been put forth in the legislature on right to work. One is a straight right to work bill that would simply, you know, say that, you know, that, you know, you can't collect the union dues. The second one would be a county by county right to work kind of position. So each county could decide whether it wanted to be right to work or not. We've got 114 counties in Missouri. And once one more than 50% voted to become right to work, then we would become a right to work state. So those are the two pieces of legislation that are out there. We don't think they're going to go anywhere. You know, we're hopeful that they're not going to go anywhere, but it's certainly something that we will keep our eye on to make sure they don't go anywhere.
Absolutely. And just also as a reminder, this was a proposition and not an amendment. So this was this did not amend our Constitution.
Right. Which does mean the legislature can overturn a statutory thing like Proposition A.
Right.
They could overturn it. I think there's not an appetite to do it because 67% of the people, you know, voted against making Missouri a right-to-work state. And many of those counties that voted, I mean, there were just a handful of counties that voted yes, and most of the other 114 counties voted no at you know, varying percentages of above 50%, you know, and some were even higher than 67%. But the overall state was 67%. So it's pretty hard to say we're going to overturn 67% of the people.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, in the original initiative petition, it was verified in all of the congressional districts, right? That was huge.
Which is absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. That does not happen where you get signatures in all 8 congressional districts that meet the threshold, and I think it was a tremendous tribute to the organized labor and their allies and supporters that happened.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know about very many other bills that have been presented that have a lot to do with labor, except I will mention, since, you know, I'm in at Local 691, American Federation of Teachers, and that's where you retired from as president. So we keep an eye on things such as teacher tenure bills, which are back. There's at least one in the Senate that would eliminate tenure for those hired after August 2019. And, you want to talk about teacher tenure bills?
Sure. And that's another interesting one because you probably remember it's probably been maybe 4 or 5 years ago now that I think it was Rex Singfeld that got the issue on the ballot to take away teacher tenure.
Yes.
And that went down in flames. I think that was in the low 70s. Like about 74% of the people voted to have teachers retain teacher tenure. So this is another one where the public is on the side of teachers, I think. And so I'm not sure where that bill's going to go, but you're right. It's to take away teacher tenure on any incoming teachers after Was it August of 2019?
Mm-hmm, August 28th. I was just looking at the summary.
Hey, August 28th. Yeah, August 28th, 2000. Then anybody who comes into the profession after that would no longer have tenure. So hopefully we'll be able to, again, you know, the people did not vote on this very long ago, and to use the fact that the people clearly said we want teachers to have the protection of teacher tenure. I will say we are going to have a charter school bill that's already been referred to the Elementary and Secondary Education Committee, and we've got a voucher bill that has been referred. We will probably be hearing both of those bills in the next couple of weeks.
Wow.
In elementary and secondary education. So those are certainly ones that need to be watched. The voucher bill, a Senate version, has already been heard in the Ways and Means Committee over on the Senate side, I think just yesterday. So those are definitely bills we're going to have to keep our eyes on.
Right. And both of those really, I mean, they affect all of us, because that takes our public money toward private entities and,
right,
and further distresses our public school system.
Exactly. So far, you know, it's really been pretty amazing. The charter legislation and the voucher legislation, it's been a combination, sort of an interesting coalition of most Democrats and some Republicans that have been able to stop the charter school legislation and the voucher legislation. So we're hopeful that we'll be able to continue that coalition to be able to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's all stuff to keep an eye on.
Yes, definitely.
So, absolutely. We have about 4 or 5 minutes left, and I was wondering if there was anything else you wanted to talk about that we haven't covered?
Well, I'm trying to think. I'm on the elections committee this year for the first time.
Great.
And I think it's going to be a really interesting committee. And I think one of the issues I think we will be discussing in there are changes to the initiative petition.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big deal, and I think this really does impact labor. In that, what you know, the just think of all the things that we've been able to get passed by the initiative petition in the last several years.
Absolutely.
That the legislature was just ignoring the people on. You know, Clean Missouri, you know, the defeat of right to work, the minimum wage, medical marijuana. You know, those are things that we actually went through the initiative petition process and we were able to win at the ballot box.
Right.
And what the legislature wants to do, because it's really circumvented the legislature, which is really what the initiative petition is for. If you don't like what your elected officials are doing, then you as the people have the right to take it into your own hands and go out and get signatures to put something on the ballot. And that's what we've done. And so the legislature, there are some people in the legislature who want to make it harder for people to either, and it's kind of on a couple of different levels. One level is they want to just make it harder for people to even get an initiative, or get an issue on the ballot. So they might have filing fees for you to even come pick up a petition to get signatures.
Wow.
And that might be a chilling effect, because some people might not have enough money,
right,
you know, to go to make that filing fee. Then the other thing, the other avenue they're approaching is to have a threshold, so it's not just a majority of the people to approve something to make it law or a constitutional amendment, but you have to have a super majority, maybe 60% or 65%. Of course, with the everything that we dealt with on the November ballot and then right to work in August, they all got over 60%.
Right.
But I don't know that that's something we want to say that everything has to. I mean, most of the time it's majority rule, right?
Yes.
Majority rule is 50% plus one. That's it, not 60%. So I think the initiative petition is something that we definitely want to keep in our toolbox that we can have to get out there and get the people to get, you know, riled up over something that they care about and then be able to take it to the ballot. And we don't want to make it so hard on people that they're not going to be able to get it to the ballot, or make it so hard for it to pass that everything's going to be defeated.
Well, absolutely. And you and I have both been involved in the past in initiative petitions. And it's a monumental effort already.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Already.
And like I say, I know we both worked on the Prop A, and that was just, I have to say that August victory was one of the, happiest nights of my life.
It was amazing
that we were able to beat back the right to work, and especially to beat it back with such high percentages. And it was the hard work of a lot of labor union members and their supporters that made that happen.
Well, yes, and to send a very strong message.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm glad it passed by those overwhelming percentages. I think if it had only passed by, 51%, 52%, the legislature would have been much more willing to step in and overturn it. But that 67%, that makes people sit up and take notice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, Representative Judy Morgan, I can't believe we're already out of time. I know today that
I enjoyed talking to you, as always, Kim.
Well, and I know today the legislature is in session, which is crazy because the weather is out of control.
Yeah.
And, so.
We're going to be in session tomorrow, too. So we won't be scheduled to go home until sometime probably tomorrow afternoon.
Well, be very careful driving.
I will. Okay, thank you.
I read your emails.
Stay warm up there in Kansas City.
We will. Be careful coming home. I've read your emails. I know that there could be car trouble. So,
okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Judy.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
KKFI presents an evening with Medea Benjamin at All Souls UU Church on Saturday, February 16th. The talk will focus on building a peace movement in an era of endless war. Co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange, she's famous for her gutsy confrontations with powerful plutocrats, an expert on the Middle East, and a leader in the peace movement. Reception with local activist groups and book signing will follow her talk. Saturday, February 16th at All Souls UU Church, 6:30 to 9 p.m. This fundraiser is a service of the KKFI News and Public Affairs Committee. kkfi.org/events to reserve your seat today.
As a friendly reminder from your community radio station, an unattended running car can be a temptation to a would-be thief. No one likes to get into a cold car, but it's best to make sure your car will be there to get into. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Why weep or slumber, America, land of brave and true? There's castles and clothing. Time or spring, there'll be peace without end, every neighbor a friend, and every man a king.
Hello, my name's Lance Waringen, and welcome back to Heartland Labor Forum. Now, the song you just heard was Every Man a King by Randy Newman, and I'm adding Queen also with that. And our guest is Tom Boris, state representative from the 33rd District. Tom, you have a little bit of say something about what you do and what you're involved in right now.
Well, thank you, Lon. It's always a pleasure to have a chance to speak to my labor friends on the Heartland Labor Forum. This is my 23rd year in the Kansas legislature, and I serve on the appropriations budget. The general government budget is what I have the ranking member position to determine those budgets, as well as the legislative post audit as ranking member. And I also serve on commerce and labor in Kansas, as well as the chair of the Kansas Athletic Commission, which was an appointment by the governor.
Okay. Very good. And now I'm going to go straight into it. What about the minimum wage in Kansas? What's happening with that?
Well, as you know, there's been much discussion over the last two or three years, a major push in Kansas to raise the minimum wage. There was a couple of decades that our minimum wage was not even being considered in the legislature, and not until other states around us started raising that minimum wage did Kansas get serious about understanding the impact of raising the minimum wage on the turnover of the dollar. We have seen two bills this year introduced already dealing with the minimum wage.
You think either one will pass?
I believe there will be much discussion. I don't know if they'll pass in the language that they are. Hopefully the discussion will lead to a tiered process that will create not only what we call a minimum wage, but a living wage for our communities.
Okay. Now, with that, we have a problem with the prevailing wage. This is a real problem, I've heard, with the Kansas teachers in this. Is that true?
Yeah, that is. And we all know that prevailing wage, just it's a requirement that construction workers on public projects be paid the wages and benefits that are found by the Department of Labor to be prevailing for similar work in a nearby locality or in which the construction project is to be performed. And that was stripped away from Kansas municipalities here two sessions ago. And specifically, Wyandotte County was the only one that was mentioned that had a mandatory prevailing wage in the state. And that was stripped out in the 11th hour of budget negotiations. And it was an up or down vote on the budget. And somehow or another got commingled in there. And I opposed the budget. I opposed the legislation. And there are a number of legislators that are trying to put that back into the policy.
Well, what I also involved in when I mentioned teachers is the due process and the idea of training and trade schools and this kind of thing you mentioned some point back.
And as you're aware, Lon, and the teachers are quite aware of this, the due process was stripped from them by the former administration and the makeup of the former legislature. What we have is we had a bill last year, 2 years ago, introduced by two legislators, Representative Jerry Stodgeville, and who was my mentee, by the way. And then we also had Representative Steve Crum from Wichita area. And we would like to see that due process re-implemented because it provides for a minimum procedural requirement with each public school district must notify when dismissing a teacher. Some people call that a protection. I call it just being fair and equitable to a Kansas worker.
Right, and as a matter of fact, all that is, if they don't have the due process, is just basically probation for their tenure, their whole school or teaching years. They have to have some way of protecting themselves from somebody having a bad day and saying, I don't like you anymore, and this kind of thing, correct, am I?
Right, and you know, due process, we had due process in place for Kansas teachers since 1957.
Okay.
And to have that turned over by a supermajority out of what I would consider nothing more than a political attempt to destroy the workers' rights, it was quite disheartening to see the effect it had on our teachers. And Lon, the night that occurred, the teachers were in the gallery of the legislature. I have never been more moved by the silence of support that the teachers and those in support of teachers presented that night in the Kansas chamber, only to see that their due process was taken from them.
Well, let me ask you something. This right to work thing, can you explain it?
Well, the right to work in Kansas, that continues to come up through what I would call the Chamber of Commerce, the State Chamber of Commerce.
All right.
They're the ones that usually push that anti-worker agenda, and they really couple it with other onerous pieces of policy that has the tones of a disrespect for skilled workers, disrespect for Kansas labor. And it's usually coupled with a tax on workmen's comp, unemployment, and anything that would give the power struggle or the power position more towards business entities. That is what is implemented when we have a supermajority that is anti-labor.
All right, so will there be a vote on it this term?
I don't believe we'll have the discussion on right to work in Kansas. I know many of us legislators are looking at the success that Missouri has just been successful in defending. What we would like to do is continue to educate as many of our friends who are on the other side of the aisle that support labor. Not every legislator up here is opposed to organized labor or the what I would consider the anti-worker rhetoric. We're finding that in times of full employment, there seems to be a more welcoming environment and need for skilled labor. So the temperament of discussion has changed a little.
So there's a possibility that, that this will change eventually.
It could.
Is there a movement in the legislature at all?
There is a small movement, and what I mean by that is, you know, we in the Democratic Party are outnumbered 40, you know, we have 125 representatives, and we are 41 in a body of Democrats. The conservatives were successful in this last election cycle. We haven't had a test, a vote test yet, as to how conservative the legislature will be, which will set the tone for us and who we need to identify to educate about the onerous, kinds of what I call the onerous at-will employment method known as right to work for less, really.
Well, I'm talking to Tom Burris, the state representative from Kansas from the 33rd District. There's another thing that's going on, the same-day voting registration. Is that going to pass, or is that going to be okayed?
Well, that's a good question. We do have a new Secretary of State, and today a committee dealing with elections chose to rescind the legislation that allowed the Secretary of State, our former Secretary of State, Chris Kobach, to prosecute what he called voter fraud. He was the only Secretary of State in the nation that received that authority from a body of legislators. And when we had a supermajority, they gave him that ability. That today was rescinded at the request and suggestion of the legislative body and the new Secretary of State, as well as the Attorney General.
Okay, that'll work if that happens.
Yes, it was a good move today in a right direction in dealing with voter rights.
Well, there's also the idea of Medicaid expansion. They're really trying to push that. Has that affected Kansas at all, like hospitals and things like this?
Lon, that is a great question. As Governor Kelly gave her State of the State presentation to the full chambers, she did give the statistical data of 150,000 Kansans that are uninsured. We have foregone billions of dollars from the federal government to address the health care in the state of Kansas. Expanding Medicaid would hit a large number of individuals who are underinsured or uninsured, which has put a tremendous financial burden on our hospitals, especially in the rural communities. We have 30% of our hospitals in Kansas are under what we call financial duress because of the low reimbursement rate or no insurance coverage by their patients, and especially in our rural communities. We've already had two major hospitals close in Kansas. We can ill afford to ignore this.
Right, and that's an employment idea, too, because their hospitals employed a lot of people. Now, if they're gone, there's no employment in that area, at least to get jobs. So could Laura Kelly do something about that? Because I've heard that all it takes is her signature to bring in Medicaid expansion.
Well, that's exactly right. We as the Democrat caucus stand ready to push the Medicaid expansion through to the governor's desk to ensure that we are able to provide health care coverage to every Kansan that deserves to have Medicaid coverage. And it will be an economic stimulator, particularly in the rural communities. And Lana, you brought up two subjects, and if I may, just 1 minute.
Go ahead.
Education employs in small communities some of the highest wages in that community. And it's the same with the medical field, whether it be pharmacy, medicine, whatever it may be associated with the medical field, they are some of the highest wages that are paid in a local community. When those jobs leave, so does the economic prosperity of a community that is dependent on them as the largest employers in their communities. And we have a number of communities in the state of Kansas, particularly our rural areas, that have been affected by the attack on teachers, the defunding of education, or the underfunding of education,
right,
and the lack of expansion of Medicaid. It's time we put people back to work.
And the idea that we brought up about the due process, that's blocking some teachers from even wanting to come into Kansas.
Absolutely. We have created a brain drain with some of the onerous policies that have come in place attacking public education. Our colleges are feeling the lack of enrollment to become teachers. We have had teachers leave the state only to be hired by our neighboring states at an increase in pay. And when you have teachers from outside our state that visit with legislators, when they tell us some of the things that they hear about Kansas and the teaching environment and the lack of support from the legislature, it's very disheartening. It's very disheartening.
Right. Now, there are some bills that are up that are, you mentioned it to me a while back, and that was like Senate Bill 9, the general fund, taking money from the general fund and doing a retirement. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, you look at the sponsors of the bill, and any time we put money into the pension plan, that one, just for the history of those that may not be aware, over the last 2 years, the administration chose not to pay the state's portion into the CAPERS, which contributed to the unfunded liability. Now, what I mean by taking it from CAPERS, they just refused to make the payment to CAPERS and put it into the general fund to help the ending balance. So what we have now, due to the brave legislators that chose to vote to reenact the former tax plan that was in place prior to the failed tax plan of Governor Brownback, those monies need to be repaid. And now that we have a surplus starting to come in to meet the needs of the state budget, there are those that took that money. Now they're wanting to pay it in a lump sum. So it is a good thing. $115 million is what the bill states to pay it to CAPERS. Right. The bad thing is it takes it off of the ending balance and puts our governor in a very tenuous position. She has talked about re-amortizing the CAPERS fund. And depending on being able to continually fund it in a responsible manner without the threat of taking funds away in future years, there will be much discussion about how this plays out. So it is a good thing that we want to put money into CAPERS. It's a bad thing that it's going to have an overall cast a shadow on the entire state budget.
Well, then there's a bill that would include money, too, is that repeal the employees get leave or paid leave. Is that an issue that's going to come up again? Or
Yes, there's been two bills introduced by the Democratic Party, and those bills, one of them is to repeal the present legislation, and that is allowing local units of government to pay those salaries. And the law stated now is that they can't pay salaries to those employees on leave, that they don't have to do that. Well, we're enacting the fact that should the county want to do that, they can. It's, again, it's respect for the worker.
Right.
We're partners in this process, and it's time that we undo some of this onerous policies that were implemented by an anti-labor legislature.
Okay. There's an odd thing here that I'm just confused on, and it's House Bill 2222, 42's, child abuse and animal abuse. Do you know anything to know about that?
No, that hasn't come through any of the committees. Well, I'll be more than happy to look up and report to you on what I understand the bill to be as we move forward, but I have not had a chance to review that.
All right. I was just curious because it caught me a little bit. It's one of them that's come up. And then the other one is the vehicles and people with disabilities. What is that about? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, we had a, and when you talk about the vehicles, I want to make sure we're not talking about mechanical vehicles. Are we talking about ways to put them into the workplace?
Right. That's the other thing, I guess, is Bill 2016 is what I was reading about. And they were talking about vehicles and people with disabilities. So was it getting a driver's license, maybe?
That's a good question. The reason why I ask that is because we had the Commerce and Labor meeting today had a discussion in reference to how we can engage more individuals, working Kansans or unemployed Kansans or underemployed Kansans that have disabilities, how we can get them into the workplace and get them to be a contributing member to the workforce more so than what they are now. And I support those programs, and I believe a majority of legislators will. This is a bipartisan attempt to ensure that if they're capable of work and want to work, we want to help them get into the workplace and help them feel a sense of commitment and belonging.
And that's where the Medicaid expansion comes into effect, and it also money follows the person, which is something that has to be dealt with in the legislature.
Absolutely correct. And you know, Lon, people just want to be respected and have a sense of dignity, and work provides that opportunity for Kansans. And we are a state of great diversity, and whether it be rich, poor, urban, rural, educated or undereducated, what we have is an opportunity to collectively come together and put in place policies that raise all ships.
Very good. What I want to do is ask one little question here, and that is, now that Kobach is gone, are there any anti-immigrant bills?
I have yet to see them. I haven't heard too much discussion about that. But I'm sure there will be more discussion in reference to municipal ID. I know that they continue to want to do away with the funding, education funding for, I call them non-citizens of our state, on the higher ed portion. There has been much discussion about that. But we've been successful as a party.
Appreciate it, and I need to get going. I'd like to talk for more time, but I can't. And this is State Representative Tom Burrows. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. You're in District 33, which is Wyandotte County, Part 2, right?
Yes, correct, Lon. And again, thank you to Heartland Labor Forum for allowing this discussion.
Sure. Thank you. I wish we had more time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So this is Judy Ansel, and if you know that music, you know that Mark Greenberg's on the other end of the line from Washington, D.C. with Washington Window on Workers. How you doing, Mark?
Fine, thanks very much.
Good. Okay, so we're going to talk about the effects of this shutdown, but I want to start by asking you, because you've been talking to a lot of labor people, what role did people play in getting Trump to back down on the shutdown?
A big role. We had both union and non-union. We had people out on the streets. We had people demonstrating. And most importantly, we had people talking about the personal impact on them and their families. What do you do when you can't pay the rent? What do you do when you can't buy gas for your car to drive yourself to O'Hare Airport to be a TSA officer? What do you do when you can't buy groceries? All that came home, and it especially came home when planes got grounded at LaGuardia Airport. What do you do when your flight doesn't take off? And all of that forced Trump to back down, at least for now.
Right. So was any of that organized by unions, or was it spontaneous?
Combination of both. A lot of it was organized by the unions that represent the workers whom Trump either sent home, meaning locked out, or told to come to work, but did not pay, be it that's the government employees, Treasury employees, mm-hmm. and small contingents of several other unions, including CWA and the Teamsters. But
right.
The rest were regular people, of non-union people, union and non-union, who were affected by this.
Right.
Contract workers in particular.
Okay, so there's a lot of people who have not yet been paid. When are people going to get paid? And how much?
Depends by agency. I was talking to one of the transportation security officers down in Orlando coming back from a convention on Sunday. They got their are supposed to get their first paycheck tomorrow. It's going to be 1 week's worth of pay out of the five that they were told to come to work on. On the other hand, you have the air traffic controllers. They're going to get three separate hunks of pay, 1 week this Friday, another two weeks worth something like Tuesday or Wednesday, and then hopefully the last 2 weeks worth next Friday.
Hmm.
So it catches catch can almost.
Wow. Okay, and then there's all those contract workers. Is there a bill in Congress to get them paid, or are they just out of luck?
In past shutdowns or lockouts, they have been out of luck. People haven't even thought about them. This time, they raised their voices, organized a lot by the service employees,
mm-hmm.
because the service employees represent a lot of these contract workers. We're talking about people like the janitors in the Federal Center in Kansas City, the child care workers, all who take care of the other workers' kids, also in that Federal Center, the fast food workers who are working for the fast food restaurants that feed the federal workers in the malls. Those folks were out of luck in all the previous shutdowns and lockouts.
Mm-hmm.
This time, there's legislation to try to help them. It hasn't been called up yet, but the two Maryland senators plus Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota have introduced legislation to pay them, too, in so many words.
Okay. Well, I guess people can talk to their Congress members and senators about supporting
right.
those folks getting paid. How many of them are there?
There's no good estimate, but I've seen at least 1 million
really?
Of those,
wow.
as opposed to 800,000 of the actual federal workers whom Trump locked out or went unpaid. At least 1 million, and one estimate I saw, I'm not sure how late this professor was, said 4 million.
Wow.
Either way, we're talking about a lot of people.
It just shows you how much the federal government has been privatized.
Privatized,
yeah.
Yes.
We're out of time, Mark, but thanks. That's real informative. And we'll talk to you next month.
Okay, and let's hope there's not another shutdown on the 15th.
Right, right. Yeah, let's hope. Okay, yeah.
Yes.
Thanks. Bye-bye. And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Tomorrow, Friday morning at 8 a.m., you can get a 2019 Missouri Legislative Session preview. If you didn't get enough tonight, you can get more. And this is from Empower Missouri, which always has really substantive kinds of briefings on the legislature. It's going to be at Grace and Holy Trinity Cathedral at 415 West 13th Street in Kansas City. That's 13th and Broadway. Tomorrow night, Friday is First Friday. And Kansas City's IWW chapter, that's the Industrial Workers of the World, is hosting a table for information and music at Revolution Records, 1830 Locust Street, from 7 to 10 p.m. Actors Equity Earth Theater presents a reading of August Wilson's The Piano Lesson. That's going to be Monday, February 4th, 6:30 p.m. at the Plaza Library, 4801 Main Street. And these are the union actors who are doing these readings periodically, and they're free to the public. And finally, our Turkish friends are having a food festival of yummy Turkish food Saturday, February 9th, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Dialogue Institute, 4215 Shawnee Drive. You can find our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find our archived shows and our upcoming schedule. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to be continuing with our mayoral forum, this time with an interview with candidate Jolie Justice. And We're going to be talking to her about economic justice issues. And we're going to be talking to Medea Benjamin about Iran and Saudi Arabia in preparation for her visit to Kansas City on February 16th. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.